Dark clouds hang over Ukraine's resistance to the Russian invasion, as the battle on the front line is tougher than ever, and Donald Trump enters the White House. We ask what 2025 bodes for Ukraine and its people.
If I were president, I will end that war in one day. It'll take 24 hours.
Against all odds and doom and gloom scenarios, Ukraine didn't fall. Ukraine holds its lines and will never surrender.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host, Zoe Williams. On this week's pod, we take a deep dive into all things Ukraine, asking whether it can hold the line against the Russian invader. Joining us for part one is Yulia Bidenko, associate professor at Karazin Kharkiv University and a visiting researcher at Carnegie Europe. We talked to her about Ukraine's strategy to get through the year ahead. In part two, Zoe picks my brains about my recent trip to Ukraine.
Hi, this is Seema. I joined Another Europe is Possible in 2018. For me, the most important thing about this space is building a transnational movement for a more democratic economy, anti-racist politics, and global solidarity beyond nationalism. So that's why I hope you join the Another Europe is Possible family too. Go to anothereurope.org/join and sign up to get access to an extended version of this podcast.
Hi, Yulia. Welcome to the show.
Hello, everybody. Many thanks for having me today.
And where are you? Where are you at the moment? Just out of interest.
Well, I spent this autumn in Kharkiv, Ukraine, but currently I am in Berlin, where I'm co-teaching the course for master students at Humboldt University, and also I'm here for a set of conferences.
Wonderful. Great. It's really a privilege to have you with us. And so I wanted to start by just asking, what's your assessment of Ukraine's resilience right now? I mean, we're approaching 3 years into the full-scale invasion, more than a decade of war with Russia. The war must really be taking its toll on Ukraine and its people now.
Well, I would like to start that in 2022 and beginning of 2023, the resilience of Ukrainian society was pretty impressive. And now there are a lot of talks outside Ukraine that probably all the society has the fatigue from the war. It's partly true because Ukrainian people are exhausted and they face with numerous blackouts and shortage of the energy supplies. But nevertheless, I would like to underline that the ability to repair and, let's say, to fix all the destruction is huge among Ukrainian cities. For instance, Russia launched a huge attack on Ukrainian energy infrastructure, and my family in Kharkiv also faced with a lacking of the heating just for a Christmas, but the communal work is repaired during the day. So it's the normal case for the average Ukrainians that they adjust themselves to the circumstances. And this ability to get back to new normality is pretty huge. The second point that Ukrainian society stays pretty united about the idea to join the EU or NATO, and there also a huge consensus about the priorities of current and future reconstruction in Ukraine and fight with corruption, and also there is a huge unity about the request for a just and long-lasting peace.
I actually have a follow-up to that. Is there no kind of political division within Ukraine? Are you not seeing any splits introduced? And if not, are you surprised by that?
Well, there are some, I would say, conflict lines in public discussions. They mostly regards the mobilization processes or divisions of the future territories which should be regained or not by Ukrainian government. But also there are some kind of hot discussion about the economical issues and raising the taxes. But nevertheless, I wouldn't say that they are too much shape the political agenda, because Ukrainian parliament is still functioning and most of the local council, they are working hard and they are adopting new public budgets and so on and so forth. So I wouldn't say that these divisions are so much reflected the conflicts in Ukrainian society, because there are some discussions and debates, but as I mentioned before, the unity around the highest, let's say, values or priorities is still impressive.
And how would you describe the government strategy going into 2025? And there's also talk of elections. What's your take on that? Do you think there'll be elections at some point in 2025? How would that work?
Well, Ukraine has a pretty clear algorithm in our constitution. And actually, our constitution is one of the points which brings people to mobilization points and to take part in the resistance. So due to Ukrainian constitutions, elections are possible only half a year later when the martial law will be lifted. So it's some aspiration among Ukrainian allies and among Ukrainian social groups about the new elections. But within Ukraine, most of people are pretty sober that under the current circumstances, elections are not possible, because it would be very hard to provide security for voters, and it will be very hard to bring people to the election points outside the Ukraine. So there are a lot of questions how to organize it technically, and the core question is how to organize the open, democratic and competitive elections. So even if there will be some peace negotiation or even agreements, it will take half a year to go back to normal political life and launch the election.
And have you seen no sign of kind of Russian interference in the sort of discursive ecosystem? I'm thinking about the kind of bot factory, the social media toxification that they've kind of planned in other nations.
Yeah, they're pretty successful in this, especially interfering in elections, let's say, in Romania or Moldova. And let me remind you that actually Russia in a hybrid war with Ukraine during 10 years, and they also declared with their propagandists that they are in a hybrid war with the Western civilization. So we can see this aftermath of this. But also, Ukrainian society is pretty familiar with the Russian propaganda and the interference. They tried to do it in 2019 or even in 2014. So we have some kind of immunity, but I would say that the instruments getting more and more sophisticated. So they try to bring some conflict points into discussions within Ukrainian society, especially it's very sensitive for those who have relatives in the trenches on the battlefields. And also they try to manipulate the arguments that Zelensky is not legitimate anymore, and probably we need to change something in our political agenda. But still, I would like to underline again that Ukrainian society faced with this kind of attempts to influence public opinion more than 10 years already. So the resilience of Ukrainian society towards the disinformation and misinformation is higher than in some European countries. For example, in Germany, there are a lot of manipulation from far-right parties, and they also play on these anti-migrants attitudes and the cost of living, you name it. So I would say that here Ukraine could be a good example how to contest this misinformation spread by Russia.
Donald Trump has promised a peace deal in 24 hours. During the transition period, his transition team seems to be walking back from that slightly. He's now talking about 6 months. So clearly the 24 hours idea was just rhetoric. But how do you think things will play out during the next month? Because clearly there is going to be some kind of talks between Ukraine and Russia for the first time since the full-scale invasion, and lots of other parties involved. What's the government doing to prepare for those talks, and how do you see it playing out?
Well, I'm pessimistic, or let's say skeptical, about this bringing peace to Ukraine within 24 hours or even during a half a year period, because to achieve peace, you need two parties willing this. I cannot see any signals from Kremlin that they are ready to negotiate, or at least they are ready to compromise something. They launching attacks on Ukrainian peaceful cities every single day. So, for example, yesterday they tried to bomb Kharkiv and Kharkiv region heavily. And from my point of view, some point of compromise is possible when Ukraine will receive some guarantees for a just and long-lasting peace. So we need security guarantees from our Western allies, and I cannot see any, confirmation of this readiness from the NATO members, for example. The other point that Ukrainian political leadership is trying to adjust its strategy for 2025. For example, we are working intensively with, let's say, Nordic countries and Baltic partners and with Poland. Yesterday, or a few years ago, Great Britain Prime Minister Keir Starmer visited Kyiv, and they talk about 100 years strong partnership, which is a good signal for me. And also Ukraine tried to work with the Global South. So we intensify our relations with Syria, for example, with the, we provide humanitarian support for Palestine. And the other step, which I consider to be sophisticated from the Ukrainian president, was attempts to work with Trump's voters. So recently it was a 3 hours long podcast by President Zelensky with Lex Friedman, for example, and they tried to bring messages to the United States and to American society. I think the Ukrainian diplomacy will find a way to negotiate from the position of strength, but we need the military and economic support from our Western allies for this.
Can I just do a quick follow-up? I mean, is there any kind of hopeful idea on the horizon that Trump will actually unite and galvanize the EU into making a better case for itself, into making a better case for its support of Ukraine?
I do hope so, because, for example, my Ukrainian colleagues, I mean, experts and even politicians, they were more sober and, I would say, realistic after the results of American elections were published. Here in Europe, especially in Germany, people were desperately unprepared to the strategic autonomy of the European Union. And probably Trump, as elected president, became a wake-up call for some European countries. So we can see some changes in the EU policy, but we know how slow the European bureaucracy is. That is why I think Ukraine also tried to work separately with some allies like Norway or Denmark or Sweden or even United Kingdom. So I think that Trump election is challenging for European unity, but it also gives or leaves a room for hope that Europe will be more responsible for security and developments on the continent.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking to us, Julia. I hope your conference in Germany goes well and your teaching for the rest of this term, and have a really safe journey back to Ukraine as well.
Thank you for having me today. Have a nice day.
So did you give me your reflections on that first, because mine are going to be pretty dumb. I don't know that much about Ukraine.
I think it was interesting because she basically conveyed what majority public opinion says about the year ahead, more or less, which is that it's quite sceptical about the prospects for some kind of settlement with Russia. But there's much more support inside Ukraine for some kind of settlement now. And the condition that the government has put on it is security guarantees, by which they mean a pathway to NATO membership or equivalent security guarantees, or they mean pathway to European Union membership with strong security guarantees. Now, that then poses the question, well, what do we mean by security guarantees in this context? Ukraine doesn't have a very good history when it comes to security guarantees. You know, there's a treaty between Russia, the United States and others from 1994, the Budapest Memorandum, which in principle is meant to guarantee the security and territorial integrity of Ukraine. But of course, that didn't work out so well. And so what it means in practice is some level of military presence by European countries, probably on the ground inside Ukraine, as a defense mechanism against a future Russian invasion. And then that brings the problem, well, what European countries are prepared to do that? And that means that the pathway to some kind of agreement looks really, really difficult. I mean, even the Polish government, that is investing enormous amounts in its armed forces at the moment on the grounds of protecting itself against Russia, basically, even they're very reluctant to put boots on the ground inside Ukraine. So if they are, then it kind of poses a question, who is? So it's a really difficult one for the Ukrainians to solve, I think.
And two questions from that. One is, what is their reluctance? Is it pure money, or is it they don't, or is it, you know, something more profound about escalation that would represent to have soldiers in Ukraine? And secondly, would Russia accept that anyway? Would they sign that deal?
Well, the last question on Russia, I mean, I don't think they would. That would be a massive red line for them. The hope would be that Russia also wants to get out of this in some way. So at least if it got out with saying to the Russian people, Putin could say to the Russian people, I've liberated the territories that we've occupied and they've come home to Russia. We've consolidated our position in Crimea. The territories have come home to Russia, etc. You know, he's got something he can sell to the Russian people to some degree. But what the barriers, I think, are neither financial or fears of escalation. I mean, there's just a quite for European powers when it comes to putting boots in on the ground inside Ukraine. It's a different calculation, I think. It's the recognition that it's quite likely that the war will start again. And if there are boots on the ground from Poland or the Baltic states or France, that France have come out and been the state, President Macron has come out and been the state that says, well, actually, we're pretty willing to countenance it. But if the war restarts, then that immediately becomes a direct conflict between NATO countries and Russia. And that's the source of the reluctance. I mean, it means potentially Polish soldiers being killed by Russian bombs. So yes, that is an escalation issue, but also just a fear of the human cost of the war and what that might mean for European security.
And would there be an anxiety in pressing for that deal that Russia was actually doing it explicitly to force that confrontation, explicitly to draw in nations that they have so far shied away from attacking directly?
Possibly. I don't know. That wouldn't be my reading of like Russia's and Putin's calculation here. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that the Putin regime is quite reactive to circumstances broadly. In February 2022, when it launched the full-scale invasion, it shocked everyone because it was an incredibly stupid thing to do. And it was like, unlike other interventions that Russia has made in Syria, in African states, etc., it looked incredibly foolish from Russia's position. Every other time it had emerged as a kind of victor from the conflicts that it had engaged in, or it had won some kind of negotiating position or financial reward for Putin's supporters and so on. This looked like an incredibly foolish thing to do. Now, but Putin thought that he would take Kiev in a matter of weeks, and the Russian soldiers allegedly packed ceremonial uniforms to have a victory parade and that kind of stuff. So he was really high on his own supply geopolitically. Now I think it's slightly different. Clearly the war hasn't gone very well for him at all. We're coming up to 3 years into the full-scale invasion. The gains that Russia has made are not insignificant, but they're pretty modest, and it's been subject to enormous sanctions from the rest of the world that are having a very negative effect on its domestic economy. So Russia probably in 2025, especially when you consider the enormous human costs of the war for the Russian working classes that are being asked to fight and die for this pointless invasion, Russian society probably does want out of the war. And it, you know, it's quite interesting in some ways that public opinion inside Russia has been incredibly consistent all the way through the full-scale invasion. It shows enormous amounts of support for the war itself. Only about 15 to 18% of Russians consistently oppose the war, and it has very large majorities supporting it. But with the huge caveat that when the majority of Russians are asked, do they want to end the war through negotiation, a large majority, equally large majority, say yes immediately. So the kind of hardcore fanatics, if you like, are about 30% of Russian society. And even the 15 to 18% of Russians that consistently oppose the war, I mean, you're still talking about something between 20 to 25 million people. These aren't tiny circles of human rights activists and defenders. It's quite a significant number of people inside Russia. So I think the calculation of the United States, and it was probably true whether it was the Biden administration or the Trump administration, Trump has just seen a political advantage in saying this. The Biden administration were very quiet about it, but their calculation is that potentially both sides in 2025 are reaching the limits of what they can do in the war, and that poses the need for some kind of negotiation to bring it to an end. But it's hugely uncertain how that is actually going to play out.
And you were in Ukraine in October, right?
Yeah, so I spent 2 weeks in Ukraine back in October. I went to Kiev and to the southeastern city of Dnipro, finishing up in Lviv. And so that was a really interesting experience. And it was the second time that I've been since the full-scale invasion. I think what people now talk about inside Ukraine, you really feel it when you're there, and a number of journalists have observed it too, is this kind of idea of two Ukraines. So there's one Ukraine that is fighting on the front line, and their experience of their life is extraordinarily different to everyone else. And there's a kind of civilian Ukraine, which is the majority, and their experience of life is surprisingly, in quote marks, marked by lots of moments of normality and everyday life persists. Now, I don't want to overplay that, because of course there are air raid sirens and people go to bomb shelters all over Ukraine. There's a curfew that you can't go outside in cities like Kiev or even Lviv in western Ukraine after midnight. So things aren't normal as such, but certainly everyday life persists and the economy is doing perhaps surprisingly well. I mean, so everyone who wants a job can pretty much get a job. For instance, the war has driven a lot of demand in the economy, so it's interesting, and that's true even in Dnipro in southeast Ukraine, where it's about 100 kilometers from the front line there.
And I'm surprised, because you say that there are these two experiences. That's why I was so surprised when Ulia was talking about how united public opinion was, because I just don't get it. You know, even if we completely park the disparity of experience between those fighting and those not having to fight, and just kind of file that under that's what a war is like, there must still be huge differences in kind of material experiences, in loss of income, loss of property, loss of, you know, there must be huge hardship in some places that isn't necessarily mirrored in others.
Yeah, I think without question, there's much more debate now over the future of the strategy for Ukraine in the war than there was 2 years ago. And you see this in opinion polling. I mentioned earlier that Russian opinion polling is remarkably static. That's not the case with Ukrainian opinion polling. And of course, that reflects the complexity of a democratic system compared to an authoritarian one. I mean, as one Russian expert said on, I think it was on social media recently, if an opinion pollster knocked on your door in Moscow and asked you whether you supported the war and showed you an ID card, wouldn't you tell them that you supported the war, given that, you know, you don't really know them? So that has, you know, there's that enormous caveat when it comes to public opinion inside Russia. But yeah, inside Ukraine, it's much more like fluid. Broadly speaking, there's a little bit more support for peace negotiations and for making territorial concessions, regardless of security guarantees that we talked about earlier, the further you go towards the front line. In Dnipro, some of the people that I met, and this was the only place that I heard really categorical statements that we needed an armistice, regardless of security guarantees, as soon as possible. So the person that put that to me very strongly, I asked them, well, would you say that that was a consensus, or is that argued over inside Dnipro? And they said, I think it's a consensus inside Dnipro. Now, I later asked someone else from Dnipro whether they agreed with this statement that it was a consensus inside Dnipro. And this other person said that they weren't sure. And, you know, I think that was a cautiously probably correct observation. But, I mean, to sort of bring it to life a little bit, I guess, for listeners, Dnipro is an interesting place to go to from an English perspective, because in Ukraine, heavy industry still means money and resources in a way that it doesn't on the Clyde or other post-industrial parts of Britain. And they've got an awful lot to lose. So a lot of the attention now is on Pokrovsk, where Russia is at the outskirts of the city. Because of the geography of the surrounding area, were Pokrovsk to fall, some people think that Dnipro, even though it's 100 kilometers from Pokrovsk, would be at risk of falling to the Russians. So you're talking about Ukraine's third city, an incredibly wealthy place, a place that's still intact. I mean, I saw apartment buildings are still being constructed inside Dnipro. People are still moving there for jobs because you can get good, well-paid industrial work there that isn't available in other parts of Ukraine. So it's not surprising that in such a place you would see more support for a without qualifications negotiation. But overall, I think it has to be said that's still a minority point of view. I think opinion polling shows that Ukrainians are exhausted from the war, but they're still quite reluctant to give up in the face of the full-scale invasion.
So, I mean, that's a story I haven't really heard about the industrial heartlands of Ukraine. It's still a would you call it a manufacturing nation, like in a kind of German sense?
No, actually, because it's had probably one of the biggest sustained processes of deindustrialization that probably any country in the world has ever experienced. So 30 years ago, we would be talking about Ukraine as one of the most industrialized places on planet Earth. I mean, Dnipro used to be referred to in Soviet times as the rocket city because it was the center of the Soviet military industrial complex that put people into out of space and this kind of thing. It was even a closed city for some time. Such was the secrecy that surrounded the Soviet military industrial complex. You couldn't freely visit the place. So this was a serious sort of industrial heartland of Ukraine. Today, and it wasn't exceptional in that regard, Ukraine was very heavily industrialized. Today, most of those industries have gone. And so even though Dnipro and Kryvyi Rih, which is also a southeastern city, those places still have very large industries, but they're not representative of the rest of Ukraine, actually.
So forgive me for asking, why were you in the factories? What was your research project?
Yeah, so look, I've been researching over the last couple of years Ukraine's economic resilience in the course of the full-scale invasion. So it's really interesting to go to different factories inside Ukraine and to ask them questions about how they're coping with the war. And the big message you get from a lot of factory owners and managers is broadly that our biggest issue is the supply of labor, because so many people in the workforce have now been signed up to the armed forces, and an enormous number of refugees are, of course, overseas. This means that in the Ukrainian manufacturing and industrial economy, there's a real shortage of workers. If you're in a strategic industry, in a strategic sector, which is defined quite broadly, you can say to the draft offices that mobilize people for the armed forces, we would like 50% of our workforce to be shielded from conscription. But it's quite common that among the factories that I visited, you know, a figure of about 10% or 15% of the workforce currently serving in the Ukrainian armed forces is pretty consistent. I don't know how representative that is. I mean, we're obviously talking about quite a small number of factories that I visited, but it does seem to be quite consistent. On one can-making factory I visited north of Kiev, they had it's reminders of the war are everywhere. So, you know, they had a board displaying photographs of their workers who had died or were missing in action. And, you know, it's very extremely sad because the board still had places for more people to be added to it. So you really see, I guess, the human cost that the war is bearing down on the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian working classes. And I've spoken recently to Russian human rights activist communities, and I was asking them, doesn't on the Russian side, that human cost drive some kind of critical sentiment about the war? And their general sense is that it doesn't really, that a lot of the advocacy you see from Russian soldiers is about conditions in the armed forces, but doesn't raise the question of why they're there in Ukraine fighting this absurd war from Russia's perspective, really. It's quite shocking, really.
That is shocking. And that kind of complete I don't even know what the word is, but the idea that the death toll itself isn't cause for concern, and the kind of peculiar machismo of Russian narratives where, you know, it's bad to arrive with the wrong weapons, but to get killed on your second day is just what war is like. Yeah. I mean, do you think that is holding? Do you think that's really, do you think people are really watching their sons go and die and not complaining under the radar?
Yeah, I mean, on that, I really don't know. And obviously, I've been to Ukraine. I haven't been to Russia. I've spoken to Russians to get their points of view on things and their insights. But of course, they're operating in a completely totalitarian, really, information landscape. So even anything they say to us is operating within certain kind of silos and things. So I don't know. I mean, on one crude materialist factor is that payments for Russian soldiers are really quite high, way above the average wage in the rural and post-industrial regions of Russia that they tend to be mobilized more from than the big metropolitan cities like Moscow or St. Petersburg. And so the cruel reality is that the war in some ways has been quite, in quote marks, good for the working classes. I mean, many working class families have received increases in their income, the likes of which that they haven't experienced in the post-Soviet era. So in some ways, it's corrected some of the devastation of the post-Soviet era. Now, that probably isn't sustainable. I mean, a lot of the war effort is being funded by oil revenues from overseas. Russia's subject to sanctions. So it's there are fragilities inside the Russian economy. But in some ways, I think 2 years ago, we would have said that the Ukrainian side and the Russian side had very different models, economic models, around which they were fighting the war. Ukraine was trying to experiment with a kind of free market-ish way to fight the war, and Russia had a classical war economy that was very state driven and state organized. 2 years later, you'd have to say both of their economies in some ways look quite similar, with the enormous difference that Ukraine isn't subject to Western sanctions and Russia is. But in both cases, we have enormous amounts of military spending that have supported demand in the rest of the economy. And in both cases, soldiers receive above average wages. And that has meant an increase in consumption for many working classes that has driven economic activity in the wider economy as well. So the picture looks, when it comes to the war economies, in some ways surprisingly similar.
So what would you say were the big challenges facing Ukraine, both militarily and economically and generally socially?
I think they've just got to, in some ways, hold on through the course of these negotiations. So I don't think this is going to be a negotiation where there is an armistice in advance of any talks. The war will be going on through the course of the negotiations, and the negotiations will reflect the balance of power within that war. So the uncertainty going into 2025 for the Ukrainian side is really around mobilization. Yulia mentioned it earlier. So can they mobilize enough young men into the armed forces in order to hold the line? And if they can do, and if they can achieve that, then does that raise a question for Moscow that Ukrainians are holding their position, holding the front line? That does the talks then become an opportunity for them to get out of the war in some way, through some kind of armistice agreement? Or do they maintain very, very maximalist goals? And one of the big contingent factors here is what happens to the global oil price. I mean, if there is in the next 6 months a sharp decline in the global oil price, that will cause a lot of economic instability inside Russia. And it might be the tipping point factor that opens up Putin, and it is in the end just the decision of one person, but changes the calculation for Putin, that he might have a greater interest in maintaining stability inside Russia in the context of falling oil prices than he does in continuing to push this maximalist overthrow of Kiev kind of agenda. So the challenge for Ukraine really is just to kind of hold on.
Yeah. And I mean, what are the numbers like in Ukraine in terms of how many soldiers they've got? And, you know, have they got what they need?
That is a very uncertain question. On paper, there are 1.3 million people in the Ukrainian armed forces. That's an extraordinary size of army by any European standard. I don't have any particular insight into how accurate or data source that I could tell you how accurate that figure is, but it is the official figure. I've read things that suggest if Ukraine was able to mobilize another 80,000 well-trained soldiers to the front line right now, that would make an enormous difference. And it does beg a little bit of a question why Ukraine hasn't been able to do that. I mean, so think about that, what I mentioned earlier about the factories I went to. I mean, generally speaking, 50% of the workforce is out of the draft altogether. Then generally speaking, 10 to 15% is mobilized in the armed forces. And generally speaking, those enterprises want another 10% of people or missing 10% of their desired workforce. They have a lot of vacancies. So I don't know. It just suggests to me that mobilization could go a little further. But on the other hand, there's all these tensions inside Ukraine about mobilization. It's very, I guess, politically contentious, or quite nasty mobilizing tactics from draft officers sometimes circulate in social media. So it's a hugely difficult question. And it's easy for me to say from the outside, oh, security experts that I've read say 80,000 more soldiers would really make a difference. But those are real people with real lives. So, you know, that's not easy at all. And so I think that is a really big uncertainty and challenge, like, for Ukraine over the next period, how its mobilization for the war effort goes. If it's able to mobilize effectively, I think you would expect that Ukraine probably would be able to hold the line through the course of the talks. But at the moment, it's a very mixed picture. It's losing ground in that critical city of Western Donetsk in Pokrovsk, where the Russian position is really quite strong. But on the other hand, in Kursk, inside Russian territory, which Ukraine has taken in the last year, it's actually gaining a bit of ground again. So it's a mixed picture, and it's really difficult and uncertain to see how it will play out.
It's really interesting, that cognitive dissonance, isn't it? When you say they just need 80,000 well-trained units, you're like, yeah, get those. And then you think, God almighty, if that was my son, I would tell them where to stick it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is so tragic. It's really sort of humbling to visit a country in that kind of situation and experience the hospitality and resilience of the people, because it's really held together remarkably well. I mean, the nightmare scenario for Ukraine would be that the whole thing basically collapsed, that social order collapsed, that there was lawlessness, and nothing like that approaching that has happened at all. So it's incredible, really, that it's been able to keep it together despite what Putin has tried to do to the country, because the collapse of social order in Ukraine would be a pretty clear victory for Putin. It would make impossible entry into NATO and the European Union. So my first reaction when I went to Ukraine for the first time after the full-scale invasion in May 2023 is that I had this abiding sense in Kiev that Ukraine had already won the war, because normal life persisted. They had very effective air defense at the time. And it really felt like this was a country that was not thriving, but really surviving the offensive. That's still my main feeling. I think that, though, there were just like much more conversations about general exhaustion and tiredness of the war effort that you definitely experience more. But I don't agree with this idea that you sometimes see from Western defense analysts and things, that if there was an armistice tomorrow, that would be a clear-cut victory for Russia, right? I don't really see how that can be considered true, when its war aims were pretty explicitly that it wanted to overthrow the government in Kiev and establish a puppet regime and stuff. If Ukraine stops that from happening, it would represent some form of victory for democracy against authoritarianism. So, Zoe, what do you think? Is the Labour government fucked? Has it lost the general election already?
Oh, wow, because that's not even as fucked as it could be, right? The fuckness would be if it had to call an early election because it was really out.
Oh, but surely not. I mean, come on, like, they've got such a huge majority, they can hang on for another 4 years or so.
So there's quite a lot going on. I would say, tactically speaking, I'm still of the view that Keir Starmer is really a sort of, he was kind of selected by his team as the candidate they could get past the members to clear the way for a different person. And I still take that view. I think the way things have gone badly for him, the advice he's got, the way things constantly seem to surprise him, I think it all adds up to he's the placeman candidate for a different project to the one he thinks he's in.
So how does that scenario play out? Does that mean that some of his core supporters, like the Labour Together people, at a certain point say to him, oh yeah, you know what, I know we've been your core supporters, but actually now your time has come and we're moving against you and we're going to mobilise a majority of the parliamentary party to kick you out? Does that moment ever happen? Because the argument against that is basically that Starmer has controlled the selections extremely tightly for all of the MPs, that they're loyal to him, so the numbers will never really exist for...
Yeah, but he didn't... I mean, he could nominally control those nominations, but he wasn't in... It wasn't Starmer's idea to put Luke Akehurst in, put it that way. I mean, these are all the kind of... Maybe Torsten Bell, sure, I'll give you that, but most of those kind of parachuted candidates for the 2024 election were very clearly Labour Together people rather than Keir Starmer people. And I don't see a body of hyper-loyal MPs whose main loyalty is to Keir. I just don't see that. And you know, when the Tulip Sadiq difficulty happened, there was a lot of grumbling in the local parties in that area that the only reason she'd got that job in the first place was because she was a friend of Keir's. And I don't know enough about North London Labour politics to know what the ins and outs of that are. But the interesting thing to me was that I was surprised to hear that he'd been kind of blinded by a personal loyalty, because I don't see him with a clique. I don't see him with a cadre, as the Americans pronounce cadre. I just don't see it, which doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it's weird. You know, if you think about the Blair Brown era, you knew exactly who was in Blair's team. You knew who was in Brown's team. You knew who didn't like either of them. You knew who was a maverick. You could just see the currents and the loyalties and the cliques, but you can't, all you can see in the current Labour formation is kind of Keir and Rachel Reeves floundering a little, Ed Miliband, them trying to freeze Ed Miliband out and never quite being able to because they don't understand his roots in the party. And then a kind of weird energy coalescing around Wes Streeting, which is because he is the darling of Labour Together. So that's the kind of tactical stuff, which I genuinely don't know how that works. I genuinely don't know whether, you know, they hit a bump in the road so significant that Keir Starmer and or Rachel have to kind of make way just to give people a sense of renewal in a party they've completely lost faith in, and then Wes is ready to go. I don't think that will work, because I don't think Wes Streeting will ever get past the members. they seem to think because the Daily Mail and Rod Little occasionally say nice things about him that they've passed the sniff test of the country. They've completely forgotten how the Labour Party works. So that's the tactical stuff, and put a pin in that. Secondly, I genuinely think there is a kind of dearth of ideas, mission and purpose in the party. And there was a really interesting thread on Blue Sky by Ben Ansell. I don't know if you saw it, about, but he was basically talking about models of growth, right? How, you know, all governments want growth. When did you last see a government that didn't want growth? But most governments have a theory of growth. So Cameron and Osborne had a classical theory that you constrict public investment and then private investment rushes in to take its place. Nobody ever really thought that was going to work, but they thought it was going to work. That was the drum they were beating. Then Brown had a kind of neo-Keynesian idea that you put more money in people's pockets, basically, and then they spend more. And that did work, but it was fueled by debt. So it was kind of Keynes with it on a kind of debt bubble, which I don't know what Keynes would have made of that, but never mind. and then Johnson had a kind of Schumpeter model. Liz Truss had her kind of crazy model, but it was a model. It was like, no, it was kind of neoliberalism on speed.
But yes. And so what's the Starmer?
And Rachel Reeves, well, Ben Ansell was saying she's got a kind of Frankensteinian mashup every model, which a lot of them are incompatible. You can't make a Frankenstein's monster out of them. The bits of Frankenstein would not just look ugly, they would start fighting each other, if I haven't overcompressed that analogy. And then he talks about her Mays lecture, but you see the kind of, there was stuff that sounded good, that sounded surprisingly good in that lecture about kind of attacking precariousness in Britain. But really what that's looked like has kind of landed in Keir's disastrous AI speech, which, you know, what was he saying? That productivity was going to double within less than 5 years? Double? I mean, it was just a person who didn't.
Yeah, I mean, we've hardly had any productivity growth in the UK for 15 years. You can't just give a speech about AI and magic up a doubling of productivity growth.
Exactly. It didn't seem to understand what productivity was or what AI was. And I think it did. It made everybody, his detractors and his supporters alike, feel a bit kind of frightened and sad for him.
Yeah.
That it would sound so random and so wishful. So you're getting a lot of wishful thinking. As I told you, I interviewed Gary Stevenson again for The Guardian the other day. And he was saying, you know, you can't just say growth three times and growth comes into being, which sounds like a kind of ridiculous fairy tale thing to say. But that does seem to be Rachel Reeves's way. She just says growth a lot, and then growth will proceed. I don't think it will. So, you know, there's a very real chance that they go the same way, just much more slowly, as Liz Truss went. There's a standoff between them and the markets win.
Yeah, I think in some ways the Labour right get caught between two forces that they pretend aren't in contradiction to one another. And so one force is that their tendency to be drawn from this world of public communication professionals that work for the private sector that makes them very inclined and prone to what you might call corporate capture or right-wing capture. I think on the Starmer's new infrastructure board they brought in, you know, the ex-head of UK Microsoft or something, you know, just like basically collapsing with weak knees in the face of corporate power. But then you have this other tendency, which is their wanting to do nice things for society tendency, which is there. That brings in the kind of, yes, we should do employment rights. Yes, we need to fix the NHS. Yes, we should have some kind of plan many years down the line for social care because we realise it's a problem and we generally support public spending and we try to raise taxes to find that public spending. But those two tendencies are resolved in the kind of Frankenstein way that you're talking about, I think, like in a way that it doesn't quite work. And it becomes harder to compromise between those two different elements. So you can't really fix the British economy without getting serious about structural reform to finance the economy is functioning. But instead of that, we get this, oh, the financial sector is still a really important part of the economy. We should support the financial sector. Let's go to Beijing and try to get more business opportunities for our bank in the Chinese market.
No, it's not a strategy. And also, of course, the whole unspoken thing about that Chinese trip, apart from the fact that it was Rachel Reeves's hands were really tied, it would have looked panicked if she hadn't gone. But going when the bond yields were going crazy, it looked naive, especially when you had Lisa Nandy saying, oh, don't worry about the markets, markets are silly. And that's not exactly what she said, but it was in that ballpark. And I suppose maybe my head has been a bit turned by listening to Gary Stevenson too much, but I used to be like that with when Cameron and Osborne were in charge. Like, you know, they would go on and on about how we were nearly Greece and the markets would have us when they were in opposition in 2009. I used to think, oh, you know, they're only markets, they're not King Kong. But actually, they can bring you down. This government can't fund itself at 4.9. They are looking at a really serious situation, and sticking your fingers in your ears and going to China isn't going to cut it. But the reason they had to do that is because they're still not prepared to have a conversation about Europe. And they're going to have to. It's ridiculous. They're going to have a conversation about the trading relationship with Europe, especially with Trump coming in, especially with growth not materializing, especially when we all know that one of the things choking off growth is the transaction costs of dealing with Europe now. They're going to have that conversation. They just don't want to have it. So there's a lack of courage from the highest possible command, married to, I think, in that Labour Right project. I still think all they really think about and all they're really interested in is choking off the left in their own party, which is ridiculous because there is no organised left in the Labour Party anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, basically, you have two levers that they can pull. I'm sure Gary probably said this, right? One is get serious about taxing wealth. And the second lever is, as you say, you know, getting it back into the European single market. If you're like thinking seriously about where the British economy needs to go in the next 10 years strategically as a vehicle and how the state can craft that, those are the two big things that you look to. But they get caught in their own propaganda around their own sort of right wing, oh, we've like promised not to rejoin the single market and customs union. We've come out with all of this anti-immigrant rhetoric. We can't go into freedom of movement. They get caught in the kind of electoral cycle, which means that they can't think about the big picture at all, really. They can't like make those kinds of long-term, difficult, challenging strategic decisions. I mean, it's a small thing, or maybe it's not a small thing from your perspective, but I thought Keir Starmer's statement about the ceasefire in Gaza was honestly one of the most shocking things I think I've ever seen him say. It started with all of this argument about the 7th of October and how appallingly the hostages had been treated and that they needed to be brought home, which I have absolutely no objection to it whatsoever, that aspect. But it acknowledged the suffering of the hostages, which is real, but it didn't acknowledge the suffering of the Palestinians or the fact that the Israeli government, in their reaction to October 7th, has been credibly accused of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and even genocide, and that there's a whole discussion around that. It just talked about the civilian casualties that followed in Gaza from the atrocities of the 7th of October. So there's no acknowledgement of Palestinian suffering at the hands of Israel. And I was like, why did you do that? Why did you see the need to come out with such a one-sided statement. And you saw, they sort of just, I think, get caught up in very right-wing information spaces, which I think even in the British establishment, I don't think that is that normal. Do you know what I mean? I meet people in the establishment all the time that are more even-handed than that. And so it really shocked me that he would come out with such a right-wing statement.
No, I completely agree with you. I completely agree, especially with that last point that there, I've heard Tories who are much more even-handed, and not even the Tories who are famously friends of Palestine, middle of the road Tories who would just absolutely never put that perspective on it. And I've also, if you look at the BBC, there's an absolute, people have run the numbers on the number of times they use the word murdered about Israelis compared to the number of times they use the word murdered about Palestinians. And it's like the actual kind of underlying bias is shocking. Nevertheless, there are so many people on the BBC who you hear make a really kind of solid, fact-based, fair-minded case for what's happening in Gaza, which the Labour Party doesn't seem capable of doing anymore. And I'm shocked by Lammy as much as I am shocked by Keir Starmer. But the other thing that they've got, this kind of Frankensteins, they're sort of merged. They've got a really unlovely cocktail of the Labour right of the past and the Labour right of the present. The Labour right of the past, and I'm talking about the past since 2010, thinks that it can appease, whether it's Red Wall voters, Brexit voters, Johnson voters, by just being a bit unkind about refugees or a bit unkind about immigrants. Or, they think they can just be a watered-down version of the xenophobic narratives, and that will bring Labour heartlands home. But then there's a kind of new element, which is anything that would be associated with the left, whether that was a pro-Palestinian argument, whether that was a humanitarian argument with regards to asylum seekers, anything you could associate with old left is immediately toxic to them. So they're kind of merging old and new strategies in a way that gives them a kind of fundamentally horrible light right identity, which doesn't galvanize anyone. It doesn't really draw anybody away from reform or Kemi Badenoch, and it repels most of the people who would naturally vote for a progressive party. So I'm kind of in my downside column. I've never known a Labour Party that I could find so little to like in. But in my up column, I just think, I've been in these kind of compassy meetings for so much of my adult life, and I just suddenly realized, and again I've been talking to Gary Stevenson too recently, but I suddenly realized we're just madly overcomplicating things. Your point about wealth taxes is the only point. There is only, just as the right ultimately always goes xenophobic, Islamophobic, identify the other, expel the other, the left always has to land on get the money back off the rich. There is no alternative. There just is no alternative. And it's not as simple as like we have wealth taxes, because obviously wealth is no longer bordered as it once was. But this does align the kind of rebuilding relations with Europe and wealth taxing in one agenda, which is we need to get serious in cross-border taxation of the super rich, or else all our welfare states are going under and all our politics are going fascist. It's that simple. So I kind of feel like, I don't know, I feel possessed with a new zeal and optimism that the arguments are very, 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 very simple, and we don't need to sit and have any more 9-hour meetings about pluralism. We just need to get on with it.
Well, just to finish on a negative note, because that sounded too optimistic, on New Year's Eve, I was at a gathering with some friends, and we're just doing 2025 predictions, and I was asked for my most boring 2025 prediction, and my most boring 2025 prediction was, you're like that, you know how boring I am. I
No, it's just I wanted to know whether they asked everybody for their most boring prediction or whether they only asked you.
It may have been an indicator of how boring I am. So my most boring 2025 prediction was that Reform would come ahead of the Tories in three consecutive polls. And I must say, it's currently mid-January and I am one poll away from my 2025 prediction coming true.